Hi, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that is mint. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined today by JB.
And I'll be here in just a second. I was just dry brushing one of my monster models.
Right.
And I have testers flat black enamel mm-hmm. all over my hands. Mm-hmm. So what you have to do is you have to then go into the laundry room and they make this special paint thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only stuff that'll get the paint off your hands. And it has this very distinctive smell
okay.
that as you continue to make models, you kind of get a Jones for.
Right.
So I'm going to go get the paint off my hands. And I guess nowadays you'd call it huff. And I'll be back with clean hands and I'll be high as a kite.
Okay. Wow, yikes. Now I'm going to have to do the podcast alone. This is awkward. You're listening to F This Movie. Fthismovie.blogspot.com is our website where you can find all kinds of lists and articles. And
did I leave my brushes over there?
Do you see
a brush?
I don't see any brushes. I don't, no.
Okay.
No brushes.
I'll look under the sink.
Yeah, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com, and you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie, and Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. We've been playing some fun games on Facebook and Twitter, so naturally you will want to get on those sites and get involved in our favorite new game, Movie Shame. Today on the podcast, we are talking about J.J. Abrams' Super 8, a brand new movie that is currently in theaters. It's only been in theaters for about 2 or 3 days. I think what we're going to do is talk about it sort of non-spoilery for not a whole lot of time, because unfortunately, in order to talk about the movie, you really have to be able to spoil it, especially because the advertising has really kept a lot of things a secret, so we don't want to give anything away, even in the non-spoiler section, so we'll kind of just give our, should you see it, should you not, do we like it, and then we'll probably move into spoilers. So go ahead and listen to like the first 15 minutes, if you haven't seen it, go see it, come back and listen to the rest of the show. Before we talk about Super 8, JB, are you back?
Yeah, I have clean hands okay. and a light head. Wow, the room's spinning.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I did. I gotta go outside for a second. I can't even put words together. I have seen many movies in the last 36 hours, and they all run together.
Hmm.
But most especially, I would recommend Midnight in Paris. I went with very low expectations because
it's wow, the 2000s, and it's Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, because I actually saw Curse of the Jade Scorpion in a theater.
As did I.
Oh, boy. But Midnight in Paris is so good.
Okay.
It is really, really good. And sort of a love letter to a number of things that I feel very affectionate about. So I was predisposed to like it. And much like Super 8, Midnight in Paris, I can't believe the marketing people allowed them to do this. There's a big thing in Midnight in Paris, and the trailer does not give it away. Now, fat chance that people are actually going to go to the theater not knowing, because every critic.
Right.
So you want to stay away from critics before you see something.
I really would have thought they would have built the ad campaign around that, because that's a hook on which to sell a movie, and they haven't.
Maybe someone persuasively argued that this film would never appeal to young people.
Right.
Given what it's about. And so it would be pointless to say, oh, this happens, because very young people would say, and that is what? That's pretty good way of describing it without spoiling it. I just thought it was magnificent, and it was so good that it made me look back and say, well, I liked Match Point.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a perfect movie, but I liked it. And I really liked Vicky Cristina Barcelona. So it was so good that it made me go back and sort of feel more affectionate towards his other films.
But you haven't seen Scoop, correct?
No.
Well, there you go.
Oh, and one more thing about Midnight in Paris. And we'll have to come up with a glossary term for this.
Okay. fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
When Woody Allen gets to a certain age, he clearly makes the conscious decision that he can no longer play the protagonist. And so he has a series of, in most cases, big-name actors
mm-hmm.
playing the Woody Allen part. And in almost every case, they do a Woody Allen impression. And I wonder, is it his presence on the set? Is there something about the cadence of the dialogue in the script? The most egregious case is Kenneth Branagh in Celebrity, mm-hmm. where it's clear.
It's an impression, I mean.
But even John Cusack in Bullets Over Broadway mm-hmm. begins to affect the mannerisms. Owen Wilson, with the exception of one short scene, is such a different performer than Woody Allen. He completely escapes the grip of ellipses. What are we going to call this?
Oh, right. I don't know.
It should be the Woody Allen
proxy.
Ooh, I like that. Right. Actually, people should email us with just that last word right. that we need.
Right.
The Goonies
derivation. Right.
The Book of Eli effect. The Woody Allen proxy. We got the first part of the term. We just need lots of words. That's
because the first part of the term is the Woody Allen.
True, but at some point we're going to need one where it's blah, blah, conundrum. I've decided that. You will not waste your money. You will not waste your time. At the theater that we go to a lot, they actually put it in the middle, which means this is a multiplex where the four biggest screens are in the middle. And when you go to the theater, and I'm sure some of the people listening to this podcast have this feeling too, you pray that you're going to be in 14, 15, 16, or 17.
I've actually waited like an hour before, I think, to see King Kong. I showed up and it was like, oh, 10 o'clock is in one of the smaller ones, but 11 is in one of the giant ones. So I waited an hour to see it on the big one.
And there was some problem at the ticket booth. So they sent us into the theater sans tickets to get to go to the desk. And the desk person was figuring this out. And when we discovered that Midnight in Paris was in the middle, I actually commented on it, and the very helpful clerk said, oh yeah, we're giving that a shot in the middle. I don't think it's going to work. There weren't a whole lot of people in there last night, because she was talking about Friday night, three screens and an IMAX screen devoted to Super 8, mm-hmm. and the other big screen devoted to Midnight in Paris.
Counter-programming.
Well, to me, it's like, well, this makes sense. Right. These are the two movies opening, but... how did we get there?
I'm not sure.
It's well worth your time. It's well worth your money. I don't think I've had a better time at a movie this year.
Really?
And the rare case, not to bring up my schmoopy, but I am evil and bitter, and I live under a bridge. And when you try to cross the bridge, I ask you three questions, or I take your goat. And it is rare that I like something more than my wife, because my wife is open to life and full of joy, and she goes there wanting to like it instead of just waiting for me to get back from the bathroom, where I've changed into my superhero costume, the superhero being the Quibbler. The Quibbler, by the way, I guess, is not a superhero. That's a misnomer. The Quibbler is a supervillain. Wait, I think I see him coming now. It's the Quibbler.
Oh, Quibbler.
So this was the rare case where I actually liked a film more than my wife, and I can't recommend it enough. It's terrific.
All right. And now the same night, you finished seeing Midnight in Paris, and then you drove to another movie, correct?
No, at that point I was incapacitated with joy, which is such a rare experience for me that it was like a form of paralysis. And my son actually had a drive.
Oh, all right.
The Music Box Theater downtown, the happiest place on earth, was showing This is Spinal Tap, because Harry Shearer was in town shilling for his new documentary, and he was there introducing the film. So he introduced the film for about 20 minutes, and then they showed a beautiful print of This is Spinal Tap with a full appreciative audience. I'd say three quarters had seen it, maybe a quarter had not.
Really?
But I have not seen a comedy with that big of an audience in a long time, and it reminded me of just how funny that movie is.
Yeah, that movie's amazing.
And then I slept for 3 hours, and then I went to see Super 8. So maybe that's what made the Quibbler come out.
Quibbler!
Oh, Quibbler! Why must you always be right?
So let's talk about Super 8.
Yes.
It's a movie. See you guys next time. Super 8, I think we are of slightly differing opinions, correct?
Slightly.
Slightly, because you liked it a lot.
I liked it a lot.
However...
I have some
quibbles. The Quibbler has some opinions.
Did you say the Quibbler? First, let me say, This is the full disclosure. When I was a child, I was an amalgam of the characters on the screen. Maybe not quite as much of a pyro as a Braces Boy, but I built models. I built monster models, and that's what I did. And I made movies, Super 8 movies with my friends, who I would try to rope into the Enterprise. And that part of the film, I thought, well, I've never really seen a movie about this. Mm-hmm. And that's just a rich vein that you can mine for nostalgia. And I think it speaks to all of us. I think it speaks to all of us in terms of our childhood experience, no matter what our crazy little hobby was. In fact, what was it that, this is not original to me. I think I originally got this from Kurt Vonnegut, that I spent my formative years on the three M's. Models, movies, and masturbation. Those are the three M's if you were a certain type of, I don't know, preteen. So that rang true. And the attention to detail, I think all of us, after we saw the movie, were commenting that the art direction is uncanny in capturing the 70s. And they usually get it wrong. They usually get it wrong in the haircuts. And I remember when I first saw Dazed and Confused, I was so impressed that this wasn't a recreation. It's like they went back in a time machine. The t-shirts were right. The hairstyles were right. Think of Matthew McConaughey's mm-hmm. weird, mm-hmm. greasy, straightened, blonde do in that film, and how you knew a lot of dudes who had that hairstyle, who didn't like having curly hair. But all of the set decoration, all of the art direction in this film is uncanny. In fact, I had a question for you.
Yes.
I wondered, because we did see it in the digital cinema.
Yes.
We did see it projected digitally.
Right.
And once again, I was amazed, because I'm sort of predisposed to hate that mm-hmm. and to be critical of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it looked amazing.
I did too. I thought it looked better than last weekend. I saw X-Men projected digitally, and I wasn't crazy about that. I wished I had seen it on film.
I thought it was bright and sharp. And at the beginning, if you go to AMC, they play this thing that they've been playing forever, where these four young people sit down and their chairs become entwined with underbrush and trees and vines. And I've been watching it for 3 years or so, and it's like, that no.
Right.
That I understand the movies transport you, but I don't want to be in a jungle.
Yeah, right.
That's why I came to a movie. If I wanted
what movie could they possibly be seeing?
They're going to, the joke's on them. It's the most dangerous game. You finish your Coke, you're about to be hunted. But even in that little opening, let's sit down and relax and watch the movie.
Yep.
The detail on the theater seat, because at one point the camera swoops in, you get real close to the material on the mm-hmm. theater seat. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy sharp. I was wondering if J.J. Abrams made the deliberate decision. This film has a very specific look
mm-hmm.
in terms of its grain or lack thereof, and in terms of its color saturation.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't make a mainstream Hollywood film in 2011 that actually looked like Super 8.
Right.
But the color saturation on this
mm-hmm.
had a very distinctive, it looked like mid-70s Kodachrome.
Yeah.
And I wondered if he did that on purpose.
I'm sure if nothing else, I mean, it's certainly designed to have a look that sort of evokes nostalgia, that it looks like something, you know, that isn't from 2011.
Which is interesting, because the blocky, saturated color would almost seem to be the opposite of, say, what Steven Spielberg did in Saving Private Ryan, or what the Coen brothers did in No Country for Old Men. And that, in that case, that's desaturating the color. That's flashing the film. I know they also did it in O Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
And it's curious that both extremes will signal nostalgia.
Right.
That if you take the color out, oh, that's the past. If you ramp up the color, that's the recent past. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I sat down to see Super 8. I was almost ready to be disappointed moments before I sat down, because this was the movie that, more than any movie this summer and possibly this year, that I was most excited to see.
This was the movie I was most looking forward to.
Yeah, and I loved the trailer, and every time I would see it, I got so excited to see the movie, and when it would show before any movie, I would say, I wish I was seeing that right now instead of whatever I'm about to see. And so I was super excited, and then just before I sat down, I thought to myself, well, there's no way this can live up to my expectations. So I steeled myself for disappointment. And I will say, while I'm aware that the movie has flaws, I found myself not caring. Even as I was watching it, I thought, oh, that's not perfect. Oh, there's a problem there. But I didn't care because I found the movie very, very entertaining more than anything. But also, I found myself invested in it, in the characters, in what was happening, more than any movie in a long time. And that's rare for a summer movie, especially. I've seen a string of movies that I've enjoyed, but they're very disposable and I've forgotten them. And this was a movie that I immediately wanted to see again.
And we come up with this almost a dismissal that lately we see things that are good, not great.
Right. Which is better than seeing six terrible movies in a row. I mean, it's the streak hasn't been that bad, but it's just that everything's average, just been kind of, okay, you know.
The average this year is much better than last year.
Yeah.
It's going to be more difficult to have the Book of Eli effect. By the way, you just hit it. Another entry for our glossary.
Okay.
The coming attractions conundrum.
There it is.
And
you got to use it.
I'm willing to bet every single person who listens to this podcast has experienced this before, because there's a period of time where I experienced it every single damn time I went to the movie. There's a movie. You want to see it. You might not be as excited about it about Super 8, but you actually dragged your ass to the theater and paid your money, and you're sitting in the theater, and the coming attractions comes up, and there's a coming attractions for something you wish was the movie that you were about to see. That is the coming attractions conundrum.
More than any, the best example I can think of was when I went to see The Illusionist a few years ago, not the recent animated movie, the Edward Norton magic movie. And right before The Illusionist, I saw the trailer for Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, which is a very similar movie about magicians. And I thought, oh, that movie looks much better than the one I'm literally about to see.
And for our listeners who have never seen either, here's my problem.
Okay.
One of those two is much better than the other.
Yes.
And that's why I've seen neither. I can never remember which is the good one.
The Prestige.
It's the Christopher Nolan one.
Yes.
You'd figure.
Yes.
And so I'm so afraid that I'm going to accidentally watch the wrong one.
You should definitely see The Prestige.
That is a hole in my in my movie logic. I have to say, Patrick mentioned that it gripped him, if I can put words in your mouth, that
please
it carried you along. Considering that this film is about my childhood, I felt a curious distance to some of it.
Okay.
And I agree that the dramatic part, one might argue melodramatic part, is very effective and it works. And if anything, I give this film a lot of credit. His dialogue, especially in the, I wouldn't say more emotional scenes, but in the more serious scenes, and because at the heart of it, this movie is about something that's very, very serious. And I wonder if one of his messages is that either the act of making movies, in the case of the kids, or the act of seeing movies, specifically scary movies, is what helps us get through real life trauma, because that's almost become a cliche. And we'll get back to that because there's some Stephen King stuff I want to bring up. But the dialogue in those scenes that are usually just between two characters is just unparalleled. In fact, there's one scene that Dana Stevens, who reviews movies for Slate.com, said is the best and most well-observed dialogue between two male characters in an American film in years. So I give this film a real shout-out for the quality of the dialogue. Earlier we were talking about a scene where the next-door neighbor character says something very simple, but it carries very great emotional weight. And we were talking about the fact that the film is also very good at showing, not telling, that it doesn't over-explain things, which very few films do anymore. I lost the thread.
You felt a curious distance.
Yeah, that at other times I felt a curious distance, and I think that's partially due to, get ready, here's another new glossary entry, courtesy of Mr. P. Bromley.
Woo-hoo!
And I think we're going to see this more and more in American films. because every film wants to be everything to everybody.
Right.
And we're going to call this the Bridesmaids problem. Okay. Although Bridesmaids was certainly not the first film to suffer from it. There's two movies here fighting against each other.
Mm-hmm.
We have a rather small personal film that you can almost see as an indie film that premiered at Sundance about some kids making a movie one summer and trying to work their way through a very, very serious trauma. And then you have the summer blockbuster
mm-hmm.
that's being brought to you by Steven Spielberg, more on that in a minute, that has to have certain action elements
mm-hmm.
To it. And for the most part, I thought the film tread a good path of keeping those things in check. The most egregious example, I think, was the train wreck sequence.
Well, hold on. We'll get to that in spoilers.
Okay. There. At this point in the podcast, nothing happens to a train.
I think with Bridesmaids, it's a more cynical problem where Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumola or whatever wrote one movie, and then Judd Apatow got a hold of it and said, no, you got to do this, 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 and this to make it a commercial hit. And he was correct because the movie's made over $100 million. And so it's sort of a more cynical problem. I think in the case of Super 8, I think it's almost like the day in the life of movies where it's like, oh, I have these two movies that I want to make. Let me just, rather than make each one, I'm just going to combine them and make them together.
And I thought another possible reason for this in the case of Super 8 could have been that it might have been the opposite thing.
Oh.
That this is a big summer blockbuster, and J.J. Abrams, who really seems to know what he's doing, has co-opted a summer blockbuster and inserted
maybe
this much quieter, much smaller film right. inside of it. And if that's the case, I give him a lot of credit yeah. because clearly that's the part I like the best, and I hope it doesn't make me sound like some old man or something. The minute stuff is flying around the screen in CGI, I check out.
Yeah. See, and I didn't, and I totally understand what you're saying. I didn't only because, like I said, I was very invested in, you know, especially the child actors in the movie. I thought they were really good, and I was very invested in what was happening to them. So when they were, I can't say much more without getting into spoilers, but I found myself not checking out the way that I have in Thor and in some other movies when it just becomes sort of a special effects spectacle. But to your point, I totally agree with you that I'm watching this one movie and enjoying it a lot, and when it begins to shift gears and I remember, oh right, it's this movie also, I was willing to go along with that, but I definitely thought to myself, no, I would be fine staying in this other movie. I would be willing to just watch this movie.
And the action blockbuster set pieces are incredibly well done. But again, Dana Stevens also points out, because she's much more cynical about this movie than we are, because she never made Monster Models, she suggests that J.J. Abrams' early career in television has spoiled him, for lack of a better word, and that she said if you watch this film, you'll notice that every half hour on the half hour, there's a big action set piece, the way they do in television before they go to a commercial.
I mean, and that may be true, but I would venture to say that's true of almost any movie.
I was watching the movie. I didn't have a stopwatch.
Right. I think almost any movie, you know, once you get producers and money involved, somebody's going to say, you need an action beat every 25 pages. Or what? I don't know what the rule is, but I promise that that is true of more than just Super 8.
And I'd like to think that there's a reason for it, but without spoiling it, there's a big action set piece, I would guess about a half an hour into the film,
mm-hmm.
that is very long and complicated and loud, and it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And I, even when the film was occurring, I thought, I wonder why this, we had to spend so much time on this.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't have the answer to that.
I don't necessarily either. But let's move into spoilers already. I know we're only 25 minutes into the show, and I apologize because if you haven't seen it, I wish you could listen to more of the show, but it really is the kind of movie that needs to be discussed.
And please note, although I can already smell the stench of the Quibbler, who's going to show up eventually, you should see this movie.
Definitely.
I mean, it is head and shoulders above anything else that's coming out this summer.
It's so entertaining, and it's not based on anything, unless you want to say it's based on the body of work of Steven Spielberg, but it's not based on a comic book or a previous movie or what. It's not a sequel. You know, it's an original property.
Well, that's something I think we should discuss, because at what point have there been so many movies that it's impossible to do anything original?
Right.
It's clear that this is either an homage to Spielberg, and I think the case can be made, because there's a scene where there's a problem with the power lines, and the city sends a guy out in a truck, and I kept waiting for the Richard Dreyfuss cameo to call even more attention to the fact that this is straight out of Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of references to E.T. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of the last shot is, I mean, straight out of Close Encounters. But I'm wondering, should I take this as value added? And because I'm very familiar with the work of Steven Spielberg, should I look at that and grin with its whimsy and appreciate the fact that that has been added to the film? Or should I approach this film much more critically and say, well, this is most of Steven Spielberg's films put into a blender and we hit frappe? Because there are elements of, is it called Almost?
Always.
Always, I'm sorry. Stupid mistake. There's a couple things from Always in here as well.
I've never seen Always.
It's a remake of A Guy Named Joe.
Right.
And it's problematic, but it's worth seeing for the performances. Okay. And I think that was some of the more subtle things. But clearly you agree, E.T. and Close Encounters
definitely
are the big ones. And even aspects of Jaws.
Definitely. I mean, J.J. Abrams has been very upfront about that. He went into, you know, when he announced he was writing the movie, he said, I want to write the kind of movie that Steven Spielberg made when I was a kid. So it's very much this homage to those movies, early sort of Spielberg. And I understand why people would be put off by that and say, oh, it's just a ripoff of old Spielberg stuff. But, you know, to me, it's like, when a movie is, I mean, we have to sort of acknowledge, like, Steven Spielberg is a pretty good filmmaker, and he's made some damn good movies. When a movie comes out that is Hitchcockian, people say that as a compliment.
Or they say this is Brian De Palma.
Right.
I don't think it's a ripoff. At no point do I think it's a ripoff. Yeah. I'm just wondering where the line is between giving tribute and recycling.
Right. Sure. But let's move into spoilers. Please go see Super 8. It should make a bunch of money because it's better than anything I've seen so far, and I don't know how it will hold up the rest of the year. But
one more thing before we spoil.
Sure.
I did really enjoy for the first hour, because I'm no longer 12, and I'm not sitting in a theater saying, get to the monster, get to the monster, get to the monster. I'm old enough, and I've seen enough movies to enjoy the game. And I have to say, the first hour of this movie plays the game masterfully.
Yeah.
And I would even argue, and again, maybe this is just for cynical old poops who have seen too many movies, I much prefer the game now.
Right.
To the monster.
Right.
The game, as you all know, is that something terrible is introduced, and then you can't show it for an hour.
Right.
Because it's so delightful to scare people with what Stephen King said, the thing behind the door. There's something behind the door. It's coming for us. What is behind the door? And you might hear what's behind the door or see something under the door. But that's delightful. And this film, for the first hour, does every derivation of that filmic trope. And I love it. I love it so much. But going back to what Stephen King says, and by the way, this is from a book called Dance Macabre that you should all read. He taught a class at the University of Maine and later turned his lecture notes into this book that feels, as you're reading it, like you're sitting down and having a beer with Stephen King and he's talking about.
And he wrote it fairly, not early, but I mean early 80s?
Yes.
I wish he would do another one because I feel like he would have so much more to say on the subject.
He kind of has, but okay. It's very different. Okay. It's called On Writing.
I've read On Writing.
And there's a lot of autobiography in that, too. In any case, I love this because he nailed it, and I teach it in my class every year. It's called The Big Bug Theory. You can scare people for a really long time with what's behind the door. What's behind the door? What's behind the door? Hold on a second. What's behind the door? What's behind the door? What could be behind the door? But eventually, you have to throw open the door. You have to. As far as I know, there's one movie that didn't. It's the original version of The Haunting. It's a masterpiece, but that's a really neat trick to pull off. You never find out what it was in The Haunting, the original version. And King says that the minute you throw open the door, no matter what's behind the door, it's always a disappointment. because we throw open the door and, it's a 10-foot tall bug. 10-foot tall bug is pretty bad, but I can handle a 10-foot tall bug. I thought it was going to be 100 feet tall.
Right.
And then 20 years from now, what's behind the door? What's behind the door? They throw open the door. It's a 100-foot tall bug. Okay, a 100-foot tall bug is pretty bad, but I can handle a 100-foot tall bug. I thought it was going to be 1,000 feet tall.
Right.
So I love not opening a door.
Yeah.
I love it more than opening the door. And in the style of when we saw Bridesmaids, I thought, spoiler alert, that they were going to leave her alone at the end. That at the end, she was going to be alone and once again embark on improving her life. And if they had done that, I would have given the film mucho credit, because, man, name a romantic comedy that does that.
Right.
And for the first hour of this film, I honestly thought they were going to keep the monster off screen,
right,
which I would have given them tremendous credit for. But in a summer American blockbuster, there's no way you can do that. One more thing about Stephen King, by the way, the scene that I really found affecting. There's a scene in this film where a young boy watches home movies that are very emotionally drenched because of events that have transpired in the film. And it's very, very moving,
mm-hmm.
For a number of reasons. And it perfectly recalls a scene in Stephen King's book. Stephen King's birth father ran off. He abandoned them. He left them. And Stephen King and his brother were foraging around in the attic one day and found home movies and a projector, and they set it up, and it was home movies of their dad. And in the film, as people would do in the 60s and 70s, he's waving at the camera. And King goes on to assert he had no way of knowing when they made the film that later on the screen, he would be waving to the boys that he abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, oh my God. And in a weird way, it's so close. I wonder if Abrams read that book and incorporated
Maybe.
It.
Right.
Although, you know, watching the home movies, it makes me think I don't see a lot of the types of movies that would do this, but I know there's a scene in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation where Chevy Chase in the attic watches home movies and becomes verklempt.
But then he falls down or something.
He's sitting on the attic door and it ends with this big slapstick joke. But I thought that was very affecting and it spoke to what Stephen King was saying. So now we're into spoilers.
Yeah.
And the Quibbler is peeking out. He's been anxiously waiting to pop out from behind a stack of back issues of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, the original version that Forrest J. Ackerman edited. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the Quibbler. Well, I like this film, but...
Dot.
The Quibbler's favorite word is but, and his favorite mark of punctuation is the ellipses, because he wants you to wait for what's going to follow the ellipses. So here's the quibble. If you're going to keep the monster hidden for an hour, when it's revealed, it should be something.
I agree.
And this monster ain't.
I agree.
This monster is a weird amalgam of three specific monsters.
Okay. I mean, I know one.
Which is?
Cloverfield.
It's a smaller version of the Cloverfield.
Which, to be honest, the Cloverfield monster, I also find underwhelming.
I did too. It makes me think that whoever did the creature design cynically believes that people who would go to those two movies have never seen a rather obscure film called Red Planet Mars.
Okay.
That features a creature that most people now call the rat, bat, spider creature. And in an odd way, resembles both. I saw aspects of Species in this.
Okay.
The alien from Alien 4.
Okay.
And, there's one more. Alien.
Oh, okay, right.
In general. And I do give them credit, and this didn't occur to me, and again, kudos to Shmoopy, because my wife pointed this out, that it was very wise to make the creature spider-like.
Mm-hmm.
It's very insecticide. It was very insectoid.
Where?
Because most people...
Best line ever.
What?
Insecticide? Where? From Matinee. You have to put the insect aside. Insecticide? Where?
Oh,
from Mant.
Man. Patrick's throwing these things out way too early for this early in the morning.
I get the feeling, I'm sorry to derail you, but I feel like they intentionally make it insect-like because I feel like nowadays, like when somebody's designing a monster, that they have to make it resemble something that we recognize, that it has to be grounded in some sort of reality, which makes no sense to me.
And that in
you
terms,
can invent anything.
In terms of the film itself, it really makes sense. And again, kudos to Shmoopy. That most people don't like insects. And a lot of them really don't like insects and fear insects and can't stand insects. And in terms of one of the themes of the film, that something can be one way until perhaps you try to understand it. And that's where, again, I give the film mad props, as my young students would say, that throughout the film, we keep seeing the Aurora monster model of the Hunchback of Notre Dame in his bedroom. And he's working on it, and he's painstakingly painting the glow-in-the-dark version. And again, like a lot of what this film does well, it's subtle. It's really subtle. But clearly, there's a connection between the Hunchback of Notre Dame, who has done nothing wrong and is punished for it and then turns bad because you're punishing it, and the central monster in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, because Cloverfield is so clearly an allegory for recent global events, if one of the things Abrams was trying to talk about in this film is torture. Clearly, this monster has been put through the ringer.
Right.
The biology teacher right. makes that fairly clear.
I was so happy to see when he showed up, too, because he's the guy that plays the science teacher in Gremlins.
I didn't put that together because yeah. my wife and I
he's
just...
He's also the guy from Aliens, but...
We just finished the Wire marathon. And
oh, yeah.
He played the mayor, the
right.
original mayor of
gets
Baltimore.
Outed by... Tommy Carchetti.
Yeah, that's the
He's like the captain in Aliens, but he's the science teacher in Gremlins, and so I was delighted to see him show up.
Oh, and that's got to be on purpose.
Yeah.
And that the army figure is just presented as being so evil
mm-hmm.
and reprehensible that I thought that was one of the things they were talking about. So in terms of wanting it to look like an insect, I say applause. In terms of this buried theme that if you punish something and punish something and torture something and punish something, you're not going to like what that does
mm-hmm.
to living things. I give them credit, but the monster design is a tremendous disappointment.
Definitely. And especially at the end of the movie when you really are getting a good look at it, it's not anything to look at, really. It's just, it's a disappointment. I agree with that. I like, too, that it's a very sort of obvious message, but that the movie is about fearing something that you don't understand. This thing comes from another planet. We're afraid of it, so let's torture it. Let's experiment on it. Let's hunt it down to kill it.
Which is a common theme in a lot of science
fiction.
Absolutely,
but I like that the way that Super 8 incorporates that theme into other relationships, too, including Kyle Chandler and his son.
But this is where the Quibbler makes another appearance.
All right.
I love the fact that at the heart of this film, we're talking about something that's not monsters. In fact, again, going back to Dana Stevens, because I like her criticism so much, she suggested that the monster is beside the point, that the
right.
monster is the MacGuffin around which the entire film revolves, but this film is really not about a monster at all. It's about how very young people deal with very traumatic events. And at first, I was giving the film a lot of credit because the father obviously doesn't want to talk about this tragedy, and that's only going to make it worse. One of the things that makes the young girl in the film such a breath of fresh air is that I think the girl instinctively knows that you have to talk about these things. You have to talk them out. Reminds me of something Penn and Teller once said, you don't fix a broken heart by pretending it's not broken. And that's something that human beings need repeated over and over, because obviously all of us are a collection of these traumas that we're trying to live through. But about three quarters of the way through the film, I began to get a mixed message in that clearly the film is saying that if you keep something hidden, it will just get worse and worse and worse. And that ties into the monster too. But, major spoiler, turn it off. There is a necklace, a locket that the boy keeps with him that belonged to his mother, and it becomes this very important totem. When he's feeling great anxiety, he takes it out. The girl makes reference to it. What is that? And he tells her, and it's taken away from him at one point, and he makes sure that he gets it back. That at the end of the film, we have the perfect Spielberg conclusion where the emotional heart of the film meets the action heart of the film, and I don't even know if I can explain this in less than 20 minutes. The locket is about to be taken from him for good. And clearly the film is presenting that as you have to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let it go. I mean, literally, you have to let it go. But doesn't that run counter to what the film is earlier saying? Or did the action of the film itself present the therapy that this kid needed, and now he's at a point where he can let it go? But letting it go seems to be akin to not talking about it.
Oh, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think it's just sort of coming to terms with something, and I don't think it's...
It's a wonderful visual metaphor, right. I mean, but, I'll give you that.
But just because he's sort of letting it go and sort of acknowledging that he's going to live, as the movie says, bad things happen, you have to live. He's going to continue to do that. I don't think that means that she's forgotten or gone or won't be talked about anymore.
Because Patrick has seen so many movies.
I've seen seven movies.
That after we
saw
this
one. Six police academies and Super 8.
And in America, that's the only grounding and classic film you need. The Third Man? Forget it. That after we saw the film in the lobby afterwards, you were commenting that, in all honesty, Patrick has seen so many films that you kept waiting for the locket to reemerge, because clearly the locket is the gun in the drawer of this film.
Not even that. It's just that, again, like you said, you can't explain it in 20 minutes, but the climax of the film is that the alien is building a ship, and it's a giant magnet, and it's pulling all of the metal from the entire town, cars, everything. And I'm like, wow, this is a long way to go to get to that scene where the locket is floating away. And it doesn't happen for a long time. Cars, everything's flying by.
And part of that is because this is another action sequence that goes on and on.
And seconds, and at one point I'm like, well, they would have done it by now. So I give up on the idea that they're going to do it seconds before it comes out.
But they have to do it because this is an American film. But I had a similar experience, big spoiler, when I saw Toy Story 3, when they're headed for the furnace, it goes on for so long, I thought, Lasseter's going to kill these characters.
Right.
Oh, my God. So that might be a new trope, perhaps inspired by the first Austin Powers movie, where Austin Powers and Jay Roach comment on the audio commentary, can you have a joke that goes on for so long that it's not funny, and then it goes on for so long
Which is my favorite kind of joke.
That it becomes funny again, and what they're commenting on is when he's unfrozen, the length of his urination.
Right.
It goes on forever.
Right.
So could this be something filmmakers are picking up on? Everyone knows this is coming, but what if you can forestall it for so long, you actually make the knowledgeable filmgoers go, maybe they're not.
Yeah, right.
That's the new suspense. Anyway.
But again, which is so much the case with so much of Super 8, so they do it, and then I should hold that against the movie, because it's like, oh, you're doing the thing that I predicted, but when they actually do it, it works in such a way that I didn't care that they had gone ahead and done it, because I was very moved by it. So it's a movie where we talk often about the Chris Farley Show, and I don't love the movie so unabashedly that I'm unable to see its flaws, but it's the kind of thing where it's like, I recognize it has flaws. I kind of don't care, because obviously this movie is designed to push very specific buttons. All movies are. And it always kind of depends on what your specific buttons are for how you'll respond to a movie. And as you pointed out, just as somebody who built models or loves monster movies or whatever, that I never built models, but obviously I have a lot of the same interests, and this movie just pushed all the right buttons for me. And I'm aware that that's what it's doing.
And I think part of that is the score. The score is amazing.
Michael Giacchino is great.
And that it does emotionally manipulate you without calling attention to the fact that it's emotionally manipulating you. I waited for his credit at the end of the credits. What else has he done?
He did. He does a lot of stuff with J.J. Abrams. He did the music on Lost. He did the score for Up, which was great. He did the music for Let Me In, which you're not a fan of. He did the music for Star Trek. So he might have done Cloverfield. I don't know, but Cloverfield didn't really have a score
because the Up score got nominated for an Academy Award.
I believe it won,
and I believe he won because when that film came out. It's rare that mainstream critics point out the score.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen very often, and everybody...
Well, because Up is a situation where if you just hear that piece of music that plays over the first 10 minutes, you can start to cry just because of the memories it evokes.
Okay, so at this point, the Quibbler is going away. He's going back into his box, but of course that doesn't mean that he'll be mint in box. Go away, Quibbler. We want to enjoy our summer. We want to enjoy it. You'll see me again!
Oh, Quibbler.
You know what? I don't think we're going to see the Quibbler again.
Wow, all right.
I think this is a trope we're going to permanently put.
I don't know, I kind of like the Quibbler.
But another thing about the monster, and maybe this speaks to what Stevens was saying, and maybe another entry for our glossary. Could we have here, in this film, a new phenomenon? In fact, I have to scour my memory bank and think about other similar science fiction films from the 60s. Because, of course, the rigid hero would always meet the girl in the course of dispatching the monster, and they would fall in love. So maybe it's similar, but the trope that we're dealing with here, I will now name Dewey Ek Monstera, where everything reaches a satisfactory conclusion because there was a monster in our midst. Having problems with your distant father? You need a monster. Your father's bitter because your mother ran out and he's become an alcoholic? All you need is a monster.
But listen,
why do monsters get a bad rap?
They fix
families. Monsters fix families.
But, I mean, obviously without the monster, it's just a relationship drama, which is okay because we both said we wanted to see the relationship drama, but... At least here's a movie with a monster that has more on its mind than just let's kill that monster.
True, and as I was deeply
because
thinking,
that's the alternative.
As I was deeply thinking about what Patrick just said, I'm actually idly manipulating my 12-inch action figure of Michael Landon in I Was a Teenage Werewolf, which you know has 26 points of articulation.
Wow.
And now, to make Patrick laugh, the Michael Landon action figure. He's a werewolf. It's a werewolf action figure.
Yeah.
He will now dance.
Oh, look at this. He's actually not a bad dancer. He's the only hypnosis werewolf in movie history.
What do you call that?
The backspin. He's doing the backspin right now. This is compelling listening for everyone.
Unfortunately, you don't get the full effect of this because it's audio. But I'm not just saying this and then, like, cynically not doing anything.
Right.
I'm actually spinning the monster around.
He's actually doing the backspin. Real quick, I just want to talk about the cast, especially the kids.
Yeah.
I mean, the adults are all good, and I thought Kyle Chandler was really good. The kids are all so great, particularly the lead boy and Elle Fanning, who you were talking about that scene where they watch the home movies. What amazed me was the way that that scene plays out on her face. She's very much in the foreground. And she does this thing where she's crying, but she does, it's like six different kinds of crying in one take. And it's all these different emotions read on her face. She's really, really good.
That shot is set up in a very interesting way with her in the foreground, him in the background, and the projector between them.
Right.
And there's an earlier scene, which I actually thought was a lot like a scene in Mulholland Drive.
Interesting.
Where the boy director of this zombie film convinces this girl in school to play this part. She's going to be the loving
wife,
the scientist.
Yeah.
And before they shoot it, they're going to rehearse it.
Yeah.
And she does the scene, and it's honestly emotionally affecting.
Right.
Which I'm always impressed by in movies, because, of course, the entire movie is fake. The entire movie is acting. So how do you present acting inside of a movie?
Right.
That's more realistic than bad acting.
Right.
It reminds me of in some of Shakespeare's plays, there's a play within a play. For instance, in Midsummer Night's Dream. And sometimes the joke is, it's not very well written.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shakespeare wrote both.
Right.
The fiction that contains it and the stupid fiction, how does one do that? That's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah. I thought you were going to reference the zombie scene also, where she has to act like a zombie, and she does this very fast, very convincing turn into a zombie, and she approaches him, and it's this great little flirtation. And then the punchline, which I loved, is she backs away, and there's just the smallest amount of lipstick on his neck, and you realize, oh my god, she actually like kind of touched his neck, and it's very exciting, because you're so happy for the boy.
Especially to monster geeks,
right?
Whose greatest dream right? is to make love to a zombie and live. Very difficult to negotiate those waters, my friend. Very difficult to negotiate those waters.
But I thought all the supporting kids were great, especially, I believe his name was Kerry, the young boy with the braces, who's sort of the explosives enthusiast. I mean, he's right out of a movie from 1980. Great job casting. And while I don't necessarily think that all of the kids' dialogue is funny when it's meant to be funny, I was okay with that because I felt like a lot of times they talked like kids and the way they talk over each other. And again, that's something very much borrowed from Spielberg, I think.
I thought it was a weird amalgam of the way real pre-teenagers speak
mm-hmm.
and the way pre-teenagers speak in 70s and 80s movies.
Right.
That it was what it was, and it was also its movie version at the same time.
Okay. The only performance in the movie that I wasn't crazy about was the guy that works at the Photoshop.
Yeah.
I thought that called attention to itself as not being very good.
It comes across as odd, although he has one of the best lines in the movie, but I'm not going to spoil it
okay.
because it's insanely funny, and right. I think you could do an entire podcast.
The last half hour, 45 minutes of the movie, I take a lot of sort of narrative shortcuts because that's where all of a sudden it spent so much time. I think the issue is that it has spent so much time sort of slow burning the buildup
yeah.
that all of a sudden it's like, oh, we only had a half hour and we have to wrap all this up. So the kids are breaking into schools and reading secret documents. And
there's a lot of running around at the end.
And at one point, I mean, they're deep in these underground tunnels and they have no idea how they're going to get out. And then the next shot, they're out. And it's like, well, while I appreciate the brevity there where we don't have to actually watch them climb out at the same time, it's like, wow, that was easy. But again, I found myself not caring because I enjoyed the movie so much. I'll bring up, because you had brought up Dana Stevens, Devin Faraci, who now used to write for Chud and now writes for Badass Digest, who's a critic I really like and who I read and who a lot of times I really agree with in a way that I think, oh, wow, you understand movies in a way that I didn't know a lot of people did. Did not like Super 8, and that's okay, but he is sort of making this his cause for the summer, I think, to point out to everyone that Super 8 is not very good. And he says the script is a complete disaster, and his big issue with the film is that he claims that the sort of coming of age, what you were talking about, that it's two movies, and he argues that they never come together in any meaningful way or any way that works, that the alien stuff fails to inform the coming of age stuff throughout the entire movie, and that the one has nothing to do with the other, and I find myself disagreeing with that. And again, maybe it's a little too on the nose, but I just think even the message of the movie, and again, the movie takes shortcuts, the whole, where you touch the alien and you automatically form this psychic bond, and so we can understand what it's thinking and feeling, and I mean, that's cheap and easy, especially because it's sort of underdeveloped. A lot of stuff with the alien.
Plus, you can argue it allows the creature to be incredibly menacing, i.e. he's going to eat you,
right.
and still give us the trope that certain people can be saved.
Right.
That it allows you to have it both ways.
Right.
I have not read the two Devin Faraci pieces, but I have to say, just from what you've said, I'm kind of on the fence.
Okay.
Because he's getting to the heart of that Dewey Eck Monstera thing.
Right.
Why is there a monster in this film?
I mean,
because it's a summer blockbuster and people want to see a monster, or because J.J. Abrams has always wanted to do a monster film, or is there a point at which the two halves of the film, these two different films that are fighting, is there a point at which they coalesce? You think it does?
I think it does. I mean, I think, again, maybe it's cheap because the message is very much on the nose, but when the boy says to the monster at the end of the movie, bad things happen, you have to live. You know, Devin Faraci's argument is that he lets go of the locket, but that's unnecessary because he doesn't seem to have problems moving on, that he's actually fairly well adjusted.
Oh, I disagree with that
completely. As do I.
I think that's clear in the film.
Right.
That this boy is having tremendous problems, and the father is hindering that.
And I also feel like when he says that to the alien, that he's not just talking to himself. I think he's talking to his dad in the same way that when his dad says, all these people used to depend on someone else, and now it's just me. Obviously, he's talking about the townspeople, but he's talking to his son. And
I wondered, in that sense, if the father's last line is meant to be not just reassuring, but I actually found it fraught with other meanings, because he's hugging his son and he's saying, I got you.
Mm-hmm.
I got you. Well, if you posit that a certain reading of this film would suggest that the father is actually one of the monsters in the film.
Right.
Then I got you at the end.
Interesting. Right.
I mean, in the film, he is embraced right. by these
right, two but at the things. Same time, I mean, he is. I think he is one of the monsters in the movie, but I think in the final act, he ceases to be. If for no other reason, then he's willing to say it was an accident in the car with Ron Eldard, you know.
And at first, I thought that his part, the father's part, was underwritten and underplayed. But the more I thought about it, in the sense that we're always saying that we prefer that a movie show doesn't tell, I thought that was really a masterstroke on J.J. Abrams' part, because that is the problem with the father.
Right.
He is not demonstrative. He is not verbal. He's not there.
Right.
So what a wonderful way of showing that. I thought that worked.
So I think, you know, like you had said earlier, that if the monster is sort of this metaphor for this problem that's growing and starting to tear everything apart, that I think that it makes sense that there's a monster. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it works as a metaphor for all of the other problems that are going on in the kid's life. And again, just for pure entertainment value, it's great to see a monster, but also this kid who loves monster movies now being forced to sort of deal with these real world, the things, you know, in the movies that he loves now are real or whatever, you know what
and
I mean?
And I think that's where we differ, because personally, I wanted him to take the monster home and show the monster how to do dry brushing.
Yeah, well, and I was relieved, you know, that it sort of stays away from cutesiness with the monster, which, you know, Spielberg's influence is all over the movie, he's big into cutesiness with the monster.
Yes.
Except for Jaws, you know, and the fact that the monster, moments before sort of agreeing or allowing the kid to live, is still killing characters who weren't military. I mean,
yeah. And eating them. I think the assumption is
yeah.
that's another problem with this creature. He
right.
tends to eat human beings.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, it's a movie that I've thought a lot about in the last 24 hours since I've seen it, and that I really want to see it again, if nothing else, just to be put in that place again.
And I've come to the conclusion, and maybe this is just me, but I don't think it's just me, that if a film is really great, you can't get it on the first viewing, and you are left in an odd state when it's done and need to think about it for an amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
The experience I always go back to is when the first time I saw Synecdoche, New York was at Ebertfest. And that film just spun my head around and put me in a place I had never been in. And I didn't know what to think when it was over. Until I had the time, I had to let it steep. I had sort of had to let it rattle around in my head for a while, for about a week. And I began to look back and think, my God, and then I saw it again, and then I got it. So, either this is true of all movies, or I'm slow.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think...
But I think you nailed it. I do want to see this
again. Yeah. And I think, honestly, Synecdoche, New York, I think is a movie, obviously, seeing it once, you know, okay, in order to appreciate this, I need to see it again. I think you go into Super 8 and have a good time and enjoy it, and not feel like you need to see it again, because I think... It's a movie that works just as sort of this entertaining summer blockbuster movie. And I think one of the criticisms, I don't know that it's being leveled against it already, because I haven't read a ton of reviews, or if it will be leveled against it in the very near future. I think people think it's a movie with no subtext, that it's just about a boy who makes monster movies and then an alien shows up.
Oh, no, that nothing could be further from the truth.
So all I was saying was I think you can go and see it if you're just this person who likes to go see a fun movie in the summer. I think you go and see it and enjoy it and not necessarily want to see it again to understand the subtext. I think you could just have fun with this monster movie. But I think people like you and I will want to see it multiple times.
And again, I think expectations played a big part.
Sure.
I had no expectations for Midnight in Paris. And that helped me to because it was so much better than I had any reasonable right to expect. Super 8, on the other hand, my expectations were so high, I don't think any film could have fulfilled them.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I know what it is, I can go back and watch it for what it is.
Right.
Oh, no, it's not trying to be that.
Right.
It's this.
Right.
Let's look at this.
And I was actually surprised because, like I said, I was so prepared to be disappointed that I wasn't, that it was the movie that I wanted it to be. It was the movie that I hoped it was in the trailers. I know that I don't know if subsequent viewings will harm the movie because, yeah, there are things, especially in the last act, that could gel together more effectively, and maybe that'll become more apparent on repeat viewings.
And it makes me wonder, in 10 years, what will be the future reputation of this film?
Right.
How will this film be regarded? I'm curious.
I think it's going to be written off as Imitation Spielberg, but maybe I'm wrong. We'll see. I don't know. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to the Quibbler for stopping by and dropping some of his quibble science on us. you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And JB, do you have any parting words for us?
You can still buy monster models if you go on the internet and spend a delightful afternoon putting them together and painting them. I recommend it.
Aliens not included.